Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the July meeting of the Melbourne Conservative Club. David was born in WA and brought up on a farm there. But years ago now, I suppose he'd say, he decided to serve his country in another way instead of farming. And so he packed his bags up and come east. First of all, I think he went a bit too far east. He went to the land of the Great White Cloud and spent 3 or 4 years in New Zealand as National Director of the New Zealand League of Rights. And then moving back to Australia, he settled in New South Wales with his wife and family, and is now National Director of the Australian League of Rights. Tonight, Mr. Thompson will be speaking on Mr. Howard's draconian gun laws and the rise of the Graham Campbell factor with the Australia First movement and the effect it may have on Australian politics. The title of the address is Gun Laws and Political Upheaval. And without any further ado, I'd like you to welcome Mr. David Thompson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure for me to be back to address the Melbourne Conservative Speakers Club, which I think I did last year. And of course, a great deal has happened since the last time I was before you, including a general election. And I think even over a very short period of time, there's one thing that most of those who identify with this movement understand that's been demonstrated again, and that is that one of the greatest assets that politicians have are the short memories of the electors. Even we suffer from that a little bit from time to time, I suppose. And I recall that last time I was here, there was great willingness to come to grips with Paul Keating and the ALP in the form of a general election. At that time, of course, no one knew when it would be. But last time I was down in Victoria, at that stage, we sometimes, just as a demonstration, did a little poll among the audience to try and find out where the Labor Party supporters were. This is a bit of a joke, I suppose. Hands up anyone who voted for Paul Keating, and we could never find anybody. And you only need to mention the name, and there was a general feeling of contempt. Paul Keating was the greatest disaster that ever happened to us. What a sod of a man he was. All sorts of adjectives were used about him. Arrogant and overbearing and abrasive, and so on, and how we couldn't wait to get the chance at the polling booth to have a go at this bloke. Well, of course, the League of Rights at that time was making the point that, yes, he was all of those things, and as a Prime Minister representing the country overseas, one of the greatest disasters we've probably ever suffered. But let's look at the overall picture a little, we were saying. Can we be sure that hurling Keating out, neck and crop as he so richly deserves, will achieve anything much in the form of his replacement? And our Liberal Party friends in particular were rather affronted by all this, and they would often say after a meeting, well, look, hang on a minute, you're not really suggesting that we shouldn't vote Liberal, are you? I mean, look, it's our patriotic duty to get rid of that Keating. That's our first and major objective. And so if you ask, well, how is it that Mr. John Howard and his colleagues are going to be an improvement on what Paul Keating are doing, it's a little difficult to get anything firm. But when we simply make the suggestion that there's no guarantee that John Howard would be any better than Paul Keating, we're always met with one response, and that was, look, he cannot possibly be any worse. And now, after 100 days of John Howard's administration, you simply don't get that comment anymore. Because time has demonstrated that it is possible to get something worse than Paul Keating. And whether we have got it, I'm not bold enough to say. But some of the things that have happened in the last 100 days, of course, do leave the question still open. Of course, the truth is there's not very much difference in terms of political policy between what Paul Keating and his colleagues were pursuing and what John Howard and his colleagues have now taken up. There is a difference in emphasis in some areas, but in terms of political style and the substance of political policy, it is basically still the same administration with a different label on the front of it. More and more Australians have come to understand that. But the question that confronts them is, well, if that's the case, what do we do about it? But really, what we're confronted with is not representative government or democracy in the traditional terms that we understand it, coming from a British background of the Westminster system, as we are led to expect is the starting point for a conservative political party. It's not that at all. It's a new kind of politics now, which could be described perhaps as legislative lawlessness, or perhaps even administrative lawlessness. If I can, I just want to make or take a moment or two to try and outline what I mean by that, because I think it's an important thing to understand before we start looking at alternatives to what we have now. If we've been listening to the press in the last few days, one thing that's received a great deal of attention is the question up in the Northern Territory about euthanasia. The focus of the international press has descended on Darwin to try and see how this thing's going to work now that the bill, the Act, has come into effect. Of course, nothing's happened up there because all the doctors are still very edgy about giving their stamp of approval to actually turning off life support systems or physically and deliberately ending somebody's life, because this is a complete departure with everything of our heritage that goes before. All our efforts so far have been directed towards not only preserving life in a medical sense, but towards enhancing the quality of life in a social sense and a political sense. And now we seem to be prepared to draw a line and say, well, we've come as far as we can. Now should we equip ourselves to begin the reverse process, start providing avenues to reverse those advances, beginning, of course, not necessarily with the quality of life, but with the length of it. Now, it reminds me very much of when I was young at university and the abortion debate was at its peak. And if you like, this is a similar form of administrative or legislative lawlessness, because it was always argued by the pro-abortion people and some of the medical experts that the facility for abortion was only for the most desperate cases. It was only for women in crisis, some sort of emergency where their lives were threatened. In order to save the life of the mother, a doctor needed to be free to recommend this fairly radical procedure. And it was always argued on that basis, and justified once it came into legislation on that basis, even though it was clear that we were legislating to give the medical profession the opportunity to take a life, even though it was unborn. Disputes about the technical aspects of that, but that was a general concession. And if we look back over those 20 years, we can now see that coming from a point where this was only to be an operation performed in a crisis where the mother's life was in danger, it has gradually developed until it's simply another convenient form of contraception. And the level of administrative lawlessness is such that we now kill tens of thousands of unborn people here every year. And we regard that as a civilized thing and an advance in social justice and medical technology. I don't agree with it at all. I think it's entirely the reverse. And if you listen to some of the medical professors and ethical professors who've been discussing this question of euthanasia, the same principles come in. For example, there was an American professor, Dwight Duncan, addressing the Australian Right to Life annual meeting only just last week, and he was making the point, it's impossible to limit euthanasia to a purely voluntary basis, because you see, the more it begins to be practiced, the further you get into grey areas about who makes decisions about the life of a patient. And he's making the point that the Dutch, who have some limited experience with euthanasia legislation, have found terrible difficulties with this. For example, if we've got a person like our Governor General, which we did have the last 8 months ago, making comments on social matters, one of Mr. Bill Hayden's loopier ideas was that we ought to look closely at this question of euthanasia because it offers a facility for the young to edge out some of those who've had a fair go at life, reached the end of their material usefulness, and should be encouraged to make way for another generation. You know, shuffle off their mortal coils and drop off the edge. The most charitable thing that anyone can say to Bill was, well, perhaps you ought to lead the way. But if, for example, you have a person like my very good friend Ted Rock, who we thought might have reached the end of his usefulness in this realm, who is going to make the decision that he has reached a point where he is not competent to make the decision for himself? And once we've decided that Ted Rock's not competent to make the decision for himself, who's going to make it? And who's going to take the responsibility for giving him the final push over the edge? Well, somebody's got to. But if he's incapable of making it himself, somebody else has to be delegated to do it. And this really is the ultimate, in my view, in a form of administrative lawlessness that is gradually developing as a system of government here in Australia. Now, in my view, the whole question of firearms legislation partakes of this concept, mainly because it's departed dramatically from the political process that we used to take for granted. And that political process was that if we're faced with a problem, then we begin by consulting those who are personally involved with the problem. Can we come to some understanding about what the solution might be? And would that possible solution be in keeping with what others in the community would accept, if it's any of their business at all? And so if we were to agree among ourselves just for a moment that the number of firearms in the community was a serious problem, then the normal way of solving this serious problem would be to go to some of those who represent people who use firearms, whether they're sporting shooters or whether they're farming groups or whether they're somebody else, and say, well, listen, how can we begin to bring this problem back under control? If you first agree that it is a problem. But you'll notice that that didn't happen in Australia's case. In fact, it almost appears that on the way back from that very moving funeral in Port Arthur, to which, incidentally, the Prime Minister did invite the leader of the opposition to go with him, in contrast with his predecessor at the Israeli state funeral for their Prime Minister. On the way back from that funeral, it almost appears, and the evidence in fact seems to suggest, that John Howard, in the grip of an emotional experience, decided that this would be a great idea and a great asset to Australians. And having made that decision, it was just a matter of how can it be organised to make it stick. And to me, it's quite amazing that it has stuck as long as it has. If we know some of the things that went on behind the scenes, and some of it does leak out to us from time to time, we could perhaps learn a little from what happened in Queensland, where the debate, I've got to tell you, is by far the hottest anywhere in Australia. And up in Queensland, of course, where they have a National Party government with a very, very wafer-thin majority in the parliament, they have a massive constituency of people who simply do not accept the suggestion that they should all go and hand their firearms in, or any of their firearms for that matter. So when the time came for Mr. Russell Cooper to go to Canberra for that May the 10th police ministers meeting, there was a strategy meeting held among the National Party members of their state parliament. And they asked themselves, how can we handle this situation, where obviously very large demands are going to be made on us? And ultimately it was agreed that Russell Cooper would go to Canberra and probably have to concede to the confiscation and the banning of military-style firearms, automatics and semi-automatics. Bearing in mind, of course, that in most states of Australia, automatics have been banned for 70 years. We still hear all this nonsense about banning automatics. Most people who talk about it don't know what they're talking about. And so that was the Queenslander strategy, and Russell Cooper was asked, Mr. Minister, what are you going to do if more is demanded of us? What are you going to do, for example, if a register of firearms is demanded, or that more than the military-style firearms are demanded? And Cooper said, well, look, in all conscience, I'll have to say, I'm sorry, but I can't agree to any more than I have before I go home and consult with my colleagues in Queensland. Bearing in mind, of course, that constitutionally this is a state matter. And so Russell Cooper went to Canberra, as did Bill McGrath and the other police ministers from around Australia, and found themselves in really quite extraordinary circumstances. Here was a meeting of police ministers, including the Commonwealth Police Minister, of course. But basically, this is a state conference. And into that state conference came a person that you might argue didn't really have much right to be there, the Prime Minister, because he has no powers at all. If you take the Australian Constitution and go through it from the front page to the back, there's nowhere in it that you'll find reference to firearms controls for the Commonwealth, except in terms of the military. Otherwise, all these powers, such as firearms registration, are specifically reserved for the states. So any one of those police ministers would have been completely justified in saying to Mr. John Howard, listen, with all respect, Prime Minister, we are taking no notice of you whatever. Our responsibility is to our state constituents. So please just leave us be and we'll come to our own arrangements. And there wasn't anything that John Howard could have done in that case. Or was there? Because by 6:30 that night, when the news was coming through, I've got to tell you that the National Party's members of the Queensland Parliament were absolutely staggered when they heard that every state police minister had agreed to the position that the Prime Minister put. They were aghast. Initially they said, no, it can't be right. The reports are wrong. Because we know that's not what was going to happen. But very shortly they were forced to concede that that is what happened. And they were staggered because Russell Cooper had basically just capitulated. When on the face of it, there was no good reason why he should. Well, why did the Prime Minister want this rugged, draconian legislation pushed through? Well, there were all sorts of excuses given. I don't really think they're reasons, they're mainly excuses. But it was conceded right up front by the Prime Minister on that very day in his press conference that his proposals were not necessarily going to prevent further massacres. He started out by saying that. And then went on to make all sorts of statements to try and justify what was being proposed. One of those was, well, look, we need to be mindful about the development of the Australian culture. We don't want to go down the American road. Now, that one in itself, to me, is absolutely fascinating. Because quite clearly to me, it means that we don't want to develop into the violent society like the United States. So the answer to that is to prevent the ownership of firearms in private hands. Now, I think this is worth examining a little bit. I agree that we don't really need the sort of Starsky and Hutch conditions inside our own main cities in Australia. We don't need the kind of violence that the United States suffers in some places. But you see, our vision or our mental image of what happens in the United States is highly coloured by just simply the television. The images that come through the television are a misrepresentation in general terms of American culture. It's a false culture. It's an idealized, stylized fairyland. And we've got to keep reminding ourselves that it's simply entertainment, if you want to put the most constructive gloss on it. At worst, of course, propaganda. But if you go and look at the conditions in the United States, where most of the violence occurs, you eventually get a slightly different picture from the one we're expected to have. And if we start, for example, a couple of years ago when Los Angeles was going up in flames, how can anyone forget the Rodney King case, where a couple of New York Police Department police were alleged to have beaten a black man terribly unjustifiably? And so this became a great, most celebrated case. And the result was that the blacks in Los Angeles, being completely unhappy about the way the case was handled and the results of it, simply went berserk at the finish. And there was rioting and there was looting and there was burning. But I want to remind you that the violence and the looting and the burning was not caused by guns. If anything, it was caused by matches, or it was done with matches, not firearms. In fact, the irony of it is that even the anti-gun campaigners, when they could see the flames and they could smell the smoke and they could see the mob coming down the street, thought, well, where's a policeman when you need one? Policemen are very wisely somewhere else. All right, well, what do we do next? Well, I'd better get a gun. So if they rush off to the gun shop, it doesn't matter how much cash they've got, The new firearms legislation says, because the anti-gun campaign has pushed it through, that there's a 15-day cooling off period before you can take your firearm away, which is not a lot of help when the mob's coming down the street heading for your premises. If we go another 18 months forward from that, everyone will remember that very amazing O.J. Simpson case, the murder trial. And when the verdict was brought in on that murder trial, it really reminded me of Australia on Melbourne Cup Day. Because right across the United States, they tell me, everything came to an absolute halt for about 20 minutes. About the same as Melbourne Cup Day here. You can be in Port Hedland or you can be in Townsville. Doesn't matter. The whole place comes to an absolute stop. There's no point in making business phone calls or trying to get anything constructive done. And the United States was the same on that day. And while that country paused, what was generally unknown was that behind the scenes, there was not a single policeman in at least four of their major cities allowed to leave. Everyone that they could get into uniform was on the street. And in the same four major cities in the United States, they also had the National Guard in place as a backup. Because they knew that if O.J. Simpson was found guilty, then the black populations of Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta, and probably New York would have torched each one of those cities. Wouldn't have been caused by firearms. It's caused by something different. It's caused by a great gulf between two separate cultures, forced to live together in close proximity in the one nation, in the United States. In fact, more than two cultures, dozens and dozens of cultures, which simply add sand to the social equation and make it more abrasive and more violent. So if John Howard and some of the other liberals are concerned about us going down the American road, then why can't they look at the cause of America's violence instead of the effects? Why can't they look at the kind of policies that we have to consider here if we want to prevent the violent society that other countries are faced with? Because if we can't see that, then all the gun control in the world is not going to make any difference. And incidentally, they tell me that in downtown Atlanta, the definition of gun control is take a firm grip with each hand, because you're forced to protect yourself in a society that violent. There are other aspects about the United States that are sort of swept aside in the gun debate down here. One of the most interesting to me is the regulations about carrying pistols or sidearms in the states. And that was highlighted only a few years ago, back in 1990, when there was the famous restaurant massacre in a little town in Texas called Killeen. And you might remember the reports. And one young woman giving evidence in the aftermath of it described what happened to her and her parents, because they were sitting eating a meal when this lunatic came in and started shooting, pretty much in the same manner as what happened in the Broad Arrow Cafe. And this young woman was recalling afterwards that she sat there and watched while both her parents were shot dead, among with a number of other people. And she said, the irony of it was that I could have turned my head and looked out the window, and there was our car, the family car, in the glove box of which was my pistol locked away. Because the law in Texas said that you are not permitted to carry in public a sidearm or a handgun. Now, this was no ordinary young woman. Well, she's a little extraordinary in the sense that she was a national medal-winning pistol shooter. And she said in her account afterwards that she's replayed the scene in her mind again and again and again, just like a slow-motion movie where you can see it frame by frame. And she said, I know very well that there were five separate occasions on which I could have taken out that man with a single shot to the head, with nobody else in the field of fire. And only one or two people would have died in that restaurant. But she wasn't allowed to carry her pistol. And so it might interest you to know that in 1995, the Texas legislature changed the law. And they permitted the citizens of Texas to apply to carry handguns, concealed if necessary, in public. And in doing so, they said, we will never again submit our people to be defenseless in the face of a maniac. And this has happened in a number of US states, including Florida and a couple of others. And the research in the time since then that's taken place is very interesting. In fact, one group who is at the fore in this research is an American civil liberties group, which are among the most vigorous civil liberties groups anywhere. And they are called Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. And the Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, based in Wisconsin and Milwaukee, have produced the statistics of what's happened in the states where it's now legal to carry sidearms or pistols. And surprise, surprise, the violent crime rate, including rape, armed robbery, all those sort of things, murder, has just dived dramatically in comparison with the other states. So it does raise the question in the whole firearms debate, well, is it a case of too many guns? Or is there another, perhaps number of underlying factors that we must look at first before we start looking at the effects? And of course there are. The irony of it is that there's only one or two members of the Australian Parliament who are talking about this. I notice you've got one down here in Victoria, an independent member from out in the northwest called Russell Savage, which is rather interesting. But in the Commonwealth Parliament, there's only one or two that are prepared to put their hands up and make any sort of criticism of the Prime Minister's proposals. Of course, there's Bob Catter, the famous North Queensland so-called maverick, who responds, of course, to a very different constituency than John Howard. And then there's a rather interesting independent member from Western Australia, Graham Campbell. Now, he really is the only one who's put all the cards on the table and said, all right, well, I don't particularly care what you think of me, but you've got to hear what I believe to be the problem. And so when he got up in the Parliament 2 weeks ago, or attempted to get up in the Parliament 2 weeks ago, to have his say on firearms legislation, he was unceremoniously sat down. Eventually, he was reluctantly permitted 10 minutes. And the strongest point that Graham Campbell made was that you're worried about people getting shot. The guns are not the problem. What's the problem is the multicultural society, generating the kind of frictions on your streets and in your cities where the damage is being done. Apart from that, of course, he said, there is the occasional lunatic. He rather unkindly made the suggestion that it wouldn't be impossible for one of them to find their way into the Parliament itself. There is the occasional lunatic. There are unfortunate people who find themselves in mentally unbalanced states, heavily drugged with mind-altering drugs that are no longer in institutions. Why are they not in institutions where they belong? Well, first of all, because we no longer have the money to give them the care they need, apparently. And secondly, because it's discriminating against somebody to say, look, well, I'm very sorry, but you're crazy. We need to look after you. So we push them all out onto the streets, give them their mind-altering drugs like Prozac and all the rest, Ativan, and hope for the best, which, of course, very rarely happens when you only hope. So to me, it seems that this whole issue has been so badly mishandled, and there's no wonder that we're feeling such tremendous heat and indignation from the rural areas. And in the end, you know, it's not actually the guns that is really irritating most rural people. Okay, they are bothered by that because it's such a fundamental, almost a visceral issue. But it's not only the firearms that's made it so. What's made it so is the way the Prime Minister's gone about this. What's made it so is the fact that they now believe that Australians have singled out firearms owners almost as the scapegoats, if you like, for Hoddle Street and Strathfield and Port Arthur. Who can we blame for this? How could it happen here in Australia? We're not that sort of people. Someone must be responsible for it. So it must be those terrible firearms owners. So the feeling in the bush is one of a genuine grievance that it doesn't matter any longer how long you've owned a firearm, whether you may have carried one in the defence of the nation, whether you've trained one or two generations of offspring how to use them in safety, responsibly, constructively. They feel as though all that's now been swept aside and is of no account, and the Prime Minister is saying to them, you are no longer to be trusted. And that, psychologically and deep down, is devastating for a whole section of the Australian community. Now, I think we need also to understand that there are three separate types of firearm owners, if you want to try broad categories. The first type is a very small, numerically, very small section of the community. And they are the criminals. Everybody agrees that the criminals are simply going to totally ignore this legislation, and in fact they're going to exploit it. No way they're going to hand their tools of trade in. they'll be hanging on to it because they become ever more valuable if no one else has got any. The second group is a larger group, but not very much. And these are more or less the young, self-centered, selfish, what you might call the hoons. There may be the kids even in the bush who haven't got very much better to do on a Saturday night, so you go out and shoot a few rabbits, and perhaps you go out on the road and shoot a few road signs and things like that. Have a few beers and have a bit of fun. They're inconsiderate, they're antisocial, and they're self-centered. But they're not the main portion of firearms owners either. The biggest group of the whole lot, by far, are your ordinary, responsible, everyday, genuine Australians. Of all ages. And if anybody's bothered to go to one of these massive firearm rallies and just look at the kind of people that are there, I've got to tell you something. On record as addressing a group coming out of a movement called the Australian League of Rights, they are exactly like you, with only one difference. And that is they don't have soft hands, they have hard, horny hands. Because most of them are labouring people from the bush, farming, whatever. But not all of them. And the Queensland Minister for Health, almost in shock himself, under tremendous local pressure, was confiding to one of my colleagues a couple of weeks ago that he was staggered by the kind of people that were coming up to him in the street or leaving messages on his answering machine. People that he's known for 30 and 40 years, grew up with, went to school with. And they are not criminals, and they're not self-centered young hoons. They are the leading people in the local community. They're the professional people. They're doctors or lawyers or architects. And one by one, they say almost as a bit of an aside, sorry, mate, you're not getting mine. No, won't be handing mine in. And he's staggered because these are the backbone of the community. Solid, law-abiding people who you go to when you've got a problem. So what are we doing to ourselves? Now, you'd have to say that every responsible Australian is obliged to obey the law. I can't see how you can take any other position. But you can't help observing that the madder and the crazier and the less legitimate the law gets, then the more it's going to be observed in the breach. And it's very clear that that's where we're heading. And that's why, in my judgment, one of the pretty hard-line National Party backbenchers in the New South Wales Parliament is simply making the point, this is Gerald Peacock from out at Dubbo, he's simply making the point, my concern is that whatever legislation we pass is workable, and I believe the legislation the way it is inviting widespread disobedience of the law. Now, is that good legislation if it deliberately invites widespread disobedience? Well, maybe it's not deliberate, maybe it's being done in ignorance. But we have to concede that people like the Prime Minister are massively ignorant about this field. So I suppose we come back again to the main issue here. Whether it's guns, whether it's a matter of trust, do we trust our fellow Australians? Or whether it's a matter of the political process? Because after this thing eventually blows over, which of course it ultimately will, we're still left with a sea change in Australian politics. And that's a change in the way we govern ourselves. Now, to me, it's not really very new. If you go back to 1983, in that election campaign, when the major, at least visible issue, was a question of whether the Tasmanians had a right to build a dam on one of their rivers. Very keen to make an impression and to hop onto an issue that had broad public appeal, the new leader of the opposition, Bob Hawke, said, well, if I'm Prime Minister, I will see that they don't dam that river. And that received tremendous attention from all the environmental groups. A lot of people had a little sticker on the back of their cars. Remember that? No dams. And this became a major day-to-day issue in that election campaign, submerging a lot of the other more important things like the economic issues. And you know, it's astonishing to me that to this day, when you talk to people in the environmental movement about that, they still believe that that issue is about damming a river. And they're still very proud of themselves that the river is free and safe and the wilderness is unsullied by the grubby fingers of the developers. But it was never about that. That issue was always about political power. Who had the power to say whether the river was dammed or whether it wasn't? And the Tasmanian Premier, Robin Gray, said, look in the Book of Rules, the Australian Constitution. It says there in black and white, quoting the section, that the states have control over the rivers and waterways. And Bob Hawke just sort of airily waved that aside and said, oh, look, never mind, when I'm elected, we'll stop the river, we'll stop the dam. And sure enough, to Robin Gray's absolute astonishment, when it came to a high court case, the court ruled in the favour of the Prime Minister. This was a massive change in the way we govern ourselves. A Prime Minister simply grabbed for powers that he didn't have, and on the flimsiest of pretences managed to take them. Some nonsense about an international treaty and the external affairs power of the Constitution, which is worth following up if you haven't done it. And from that time on, every Commonwealth Parliament has exploited that High Court decision on whatever flimsy United Nations or international convention or agreement or treaty to impose their will on the states and the people right across the country. More and more, that seems to be the way we're governing ourselves here. In fact, I call it government by press release and bulletproof vest, because basically that's it. And it originally started, I guess, in a more defensible way, when a treasurer was bringing down a budget. And because of the nature of financial legislation and so on, so that no one got unfair advantage and got inside information and belted in and made a fortune on the stock exchange the day before, it was always a secret document until the Treasurer released it to the Parliament. And this thing basically was a document that was set in stone. The Treasurer is telling the Parliament, this is what we're going to do. This is our legislative and financial program for the next 12 months. And after that, from the Prime Minister down, everybody on the government side of the House was expected to go out into the community and sell that budget to the people, no matter how unwilling they happen to be to accept its contents. So you had a sort of little game going here. Okay, we're sorry, we know you don't like it, but it's for the best in the end, and the betterment of the nation, and you'll thank us for us afterwards, and please put up with the pain now because the gain comes later. And, you know, this little game went on every budget, unless it was election time. But now it's more than just budgets. And this firearms legislation, to me, is the absolute classical case. You announce what you're going to do, like some sort of god on top of Mount Olympus, and then you send out all the troops to sell the case to, no matter how reluctant, a populace you're imposing it on. And so, to me, it reached the height of absurdity when the Prime Minister went down to Sale a month or so ago to explain the benefit of this proposed change to some pretty angry and bitter and highly resistant rural people, the descendants of some of the best pioneering stock the place has ever seen. Basically, the Australian salt of the earth. And I can't think of a greater insult that a Prime Minister could offer his own people than to go down there wearing a bulletproof vest. As if to say, I know that you're going to have a go at shooting me for what I've done. There's no reason why I should trust you, so I'm protecting myself. What a tremendous slap in the face. And you know, the most dreadful thing about it in my mind is that that man, the Prime Minister of Australia, did not even realise he was insulting those people. How incredible. How incredible. And then on top of all that, the Prime Minister had the gall to say to the staff and the press corps and so on the way back that it went okay. Okay, they were pretty angry and they were a little bit upset and uptight, but it went okay. You know, this is democracy at work. This is democracy at work. Have you ever heard of anything as ridiculous? If democracy means grabbing powers that don't belong to you from somebody else and then imposing them with no consultation on everybody for an alleged transgression that we know none of them committed, then we're really in the wrong game. There's nothing democratic at all. This is a classic totalitarian process. And I don't know why somebody doesn't come right out and say so, because the longer it goes on, the more transparent it becomes. In a genuine process of representative government, as I said right at the beginning, you'd go and consult with the special interest groups, wouldn't you? Now, it's ironic that in some fields we seem to be extremely good at that. Take, for example, some other minority groups who for some reason seem to get tremendous consideration. Take, for example, one of the most vicious and potent minority lobby groups that we've got, and that's the homosexual lobby. A member in the Parliament for Western Australia, O'Connor, Wilson Tuckey, was saying at a meeting in Perth last weekend that if we're going to ban firearms, which kill, a couple of dozen people a year, then why don't we do something about one of the most serious killers that our young people are faced with? Far more potent than a pistol. Why don't we do something about AIDS? Which we all know is almost completely confined to the homosexual people. Let's not call it a community, but homosexual people. To the sodomites. And yet, whenever that's suggested, there's a great uproar. Well, you can't do that. That's discrimination and it's all the rest. But if it is treated as a public health issue, as it should be, then we'd be doing something like Fidel Castro does in Cuba. And you know, in Cuba, which is a totalitarian state, obviously, they take a very different approach to this particular public health epidemic. They undertake to test everybody in Cuba for AIDS twice a year. And if you show up positive, then you're invited to go and spend the rest of your life until you're clear from the positive swab in a specially separated hospice. In other words, you're alienated from the community. You're put in quarantine. Because that's a logical step to take. Well, if you don't have to listen too much to the uproar from a minority group like Fidel Castro doesn't, then you get away with that. But here in Australia, at least we could face the problem properly and say, all right, if we're going to spend $500 million on buying back a few guns, surely we can spend a few million dollars on getting this particular public health menace right under control and starting not with the effects, which is the disease, but the cause, which is the lifestyle. You could very profitably use that money or even a fraction of it in a proper educational process through the school so the kids understand how you get AIDS and where sodomy actually leads you. So that's one minority group that seems to get outrageous consideration alongside this other minority group called the shooters. Or else you could look a little bit further to another minority group like the Aborigines. Now it's true that they are some of the most disadvantaged people in the community because I've lived near them when I was younger and I know what the conditions are like. So it's perhaps not unreasonable that they do get some consideration. But as Pauline Hanson has been pointing out, well look, aren't we going a little bit far when the consideration that they're given is based not upon being disadvantaged people, but on the colour of their skin? And even the former Governor General, Bill Hayden, concedes that she's really got a pretty strong point when she asks, why should one family living here be paying a 10% mortgage when their next door neighbours, who happen to be Aborigines, are paying about a 4 or 5% mortgage? Now, is this not some form of discrimination, or have I missed something here? And quite clearly, there's a strong point to be made. But this minority group known as the Aborigines seem to be more politically correct than shooters. And so when it comes to a thing of absolutely national or even international significance, like this massive Century Zinc mining proposal up in North Queensland, you find that this small minority group gets a rather impressive consideration from the government. Now, the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs is on record as saying that this is a project of national and international significance. It is going to be the biggest zinc mine anywhere on the face of the globe. And if for a moment you accept the conventional economic wisdom that this thing is essential for the economic and financial prosperity of Australia, which I think myself is rubbish, but still, if you accept that, which the economists all do, then surely that's far more important than a few high-powered rifles and a blasted broom cupboard. And yet the minority group who seems to be complaining about this issue is accorded every facility and every consideration, bending over backwards for weeks at a time and making a decision about this mine. Compare that with the treatment of the shooters, and is it any wonder that in the bush they're a little irritated? So, Mr. Chairman, in my view, we've really changed dramatically our outlook on this question of constitutional government where minority groups are given the sort of consideration that minority groups should be given, because democracy itself consists of more than just counting heads and whoever has 51% of the vote gets to do basically what they like. It consists of representative government and government by consent. Remember that old phrase that we even learned in school, no taxation without representation. Well, you're being taxed, let me tell you, on this firearms business to get the guns out of the broom cupboards, but you've never been asked. Never been asked. Nobody has. And so, coming back again to where I started, how did it all happen? Well, you hear lots of rumours about that meeting on May the 10th in Canberra, the police minister's meeting. And one of the most interesting rumours that we've been picking up for a very long time is how John Howard managed to convince those police ministers to do what he wanted. And of course, some of the press reports have been highly eulogistic of Mr. Howard. They've said, look, this bloke has the most amazing powers of persuasion to get such a disparate group to agree to the same program. You know, some sort of a political wizard here. But when the facts begin to leak out as they are now, the story is very different. And there was a press report in one of your Melbourne papers last week which picks up and confirms many of the stories that we've been hearing. And when Russell Cooper got back to Queensland and was confronted with a bitterly angry party room who put him right on the mat and said, Russell Cooper, what the devil have you done? He said, well, look, I'm sorry, blokes, but there wasn't any choice. He said, John Howard basically came in, delivered a cast-iron ultimatum, and walked out again. And the ultimatum basically was, you, the states, might technically have the power to legislate on firearms, but we, the Commonwealth, hold the purse strings. So unless you toe the line and do exactly what we're asking, then we can make life absolutely impossible for you by cutting off the money and doing a number of other things. He then went around the table and dealt with each state minister of police, starting with the Northern Territory, and said to the Territorians, you people have got a few little problems. First of all, you want money to build a railroad from Alice Springs to Darwin. The price of that railway is signing on the dotted line today. And if you don't do it, you can forget statehood on top of that as well. And from one to the other, pointing out the problems they had, financial problems, economic problems, legislative problems, native title, whatever else it might be. Until Shane Stone, the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, writing to some of his supporters after the event, said, well, listen, you know, the fact of the matter is that we just never had the ghost of a chance. These are standover tactics that the mafia in New York would die for. And it's happening in what we used to think was a free country. Being done by a Prime Minister who's supposed to be from the conservative side of politics, supposed to have some commitment to representative government. So, Mr. Chairman, is there any wonder that there's going to be some sort of a backlash? I want to move on to perhaps the most critical part and leave the firearms thing aside now, except to make one last observation. And that is that, in my view, the uproar in country areas, which is partially and more substantially than we might expect in some cases, reflected in city areas, is partly the result of the firearms issue being a catalyst for other things. And those other things are basic and fundamental issues that a lot of Australians have been deeply irritated about for a long time now. And there might be things, for example, that affect their kids, like an unemployment problem. And when you see formal government policy to eliminate the Australian industrial base by the reduction of tariffs and import duties and all that sort of thing, you can't help but wonder, well, look, what's going on? And it really does irritate people. Savagely. It is just not quite enough for them to tear up their membership of the Liberal Party or the ALP or to write a letter to the Member of Parliament, or write a letter to the paper, or go and see somebody in charge and say, listen, this is ridiculous why we do it. It's not quite that bad, but it's pretty irritating all the same. And alongside that, we've got other irritants like the Republic. Well, that swine Keating, doesn't he get under your skin with the way he goes on about it and the flag? It's an irritant, but it's not enough to get you on the streets and demonstrate. Or the question of immigration. Another irritant. Institutionalized multiculturalism. Another thing that really people never been consulted about. Imposed on us without our will. Put all these little irritants together and shove a detonator right in the middle called gun control, and the whole thing just goes sky high. That's what's happening to us. And it's happening partly because one person has managed to gather up all those threads and put them together and say, listen, there's a list of things that we're not addressing here. And that person is Graham Campbell. And before the last election, he published his little list and said, look, these are the real issues. The Labour Party's turned their back on them, the Liberal Party's turned their back on them, and so has everybody else, with a few minor exceptions, like the Democrats in some area, or the National Party on one issue, and so on. So he simply ran them like a flag up the mast and said, if I have any say, these are the things we're going to look at. And he got a tremendous response. And so it begs the question that, what is going to happen from here on? Well, first of all, we've got to look at the state of one particular political party, the National Party. Now, you probably don't feel it so much here in the city, in the heart of Melbourne. But you've only got to take a trip through the bush and you can almost feel it. The National Party is finished. Finished. Even their own hardcore constituents are saying, why do we bother? I mean, you know, they're the same as the Labour Party, particularly on things like the gun issue, or the Liberal Party, so why would we bother voting National? And the effects are starting to show, and did start to show very quickly. You remember a series of 5 by-elections up in New South Wales, shortly after this May the 10th debacle took place in Canberra. And the shock of the whole thing was that the National Party lost a cast-iron safe National Party seat called Clarence, that they should never have lost. And so the Liberal Party hopped up and said, oh, there you are, see, it's that wretched gun lobby already. They're at us. And the firearms groups up on the North Coast were sort of a bit bemused by this and scratched their heads and said, well, look, we haven't done anything yet. Not too well organised at the best of times. They didn't have to do anything because the National Party, Heartland itself, simply refused to cooperate with the party. When the party said, come on, we've got to man the polling booths and hand out the propaganda and rev up the crowds to vote National, they said, look, mates, forget it. Count us out. So one after the other, they went for traditional National Party supporters. Not only did they find that they wouldn't man polling booths or anything like that, but they found that the checkbooks were shut and right stuffed in the back pocket. That's why they lost Clarence, because they couldn't run a by-election. And the feeling I pick up right through the bush is that they won't be able to run a chook raffle in a few weeks if the states agree to this legislation. So in my view, it's only a matter of time now before the National Party either disintegrates or undergoes a tremendous political sea change to get it back on some sort of course. But if it does disappear or begin to deteriorate, it leaves a vacuum in politics. And politics doesn't like a vacuum. Something always turns up to fill it, no matter how ridiculous it is. And so the question is, what might turn up? Well, there's some very interesting possibilities, and they all seem to centre around this person, Graham Campbell, and what he might propose to do. I don't know if you saw it, but in the Weekend Australian a few weeks ago, on the 15th of June, there's a press report by a social analyst called Hugh Mackay. And Hugh Mackay is examining this whole question of disaffected groups and what they might do in a coalition, coalescing around one particular focus, like Graham Campbell. And there's a little paragraph there. He's rather nervous about all this, mind you. He's rather distressed about it. But he's saying, if Graham Campbell's attempt to form the Australia First Party succeeds, it mightn't represent the so-called silent majority, but it could well bring together a disparate collection of disaffected subgroups. If Campbell and his mates play their cards right, they could create a major third force in Australian politics. A force which would make John Howard and his Liberals look like left-leaning pinkos. And in my view, that rather neatly sums the situation up. I think maybe it's worth just a brief diversion to look for an example where other people have been in this type of situation. And there aren't too many similarities, really. But one similarity we just might look at briefly is the situation in Canada at the end of the 1970s and the early 1980s. And the Canadians have been through then roughly the sort of period that we'd been through in 1972 to 1975 with Gough Whitlam, except theirs lasted a lot longer. And they had a prime minister called Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who was basically out of a pro-communist background and a Fabian outlook. And Trudeau spent a number of years in office in Canada trashing whatever Canadian institutions he could get his hands on. And once they finally got rid of Trudeau, they eventually finished up with the Progressive Conservative government, which is their Tory party, I suppose, the equivalent of the Liberal coalition here, under the leadership of Brian Mulroney. And at that particular time, you've almost got similar circumstances to ours here. When finally we get rid of this swine Keating, and we've got back to Conservative government with John Howard. And the Conservatives under Mulroney in Canada really did not very much different from what Trudeau had started 10 years before. And it wasn't too long before there was tremendous dissatisfaction right across Canada with the Progressive Conservatives, Mulroney's government. And out in the western areas, there'd been a ginger group for many, many years. I suppose you might say the remnants of the old social credit movement, who were always pointing out that the concentration of political power was a danger that had to be avoided in Canada. And how do you create a mechanism where perhaps you can have some say? Well, one group said the only answer is we've got to secede from those maniacs over in the east and run our own nation, Western Canada. And they had a movement called the Western Canada Concept. And gradually this type of movement began to develop and to mature until in 1985 there was a party formed called the Reform Party of Canada. And the Reform Party of Canada went through a number of years of sort of difficulties and I suppose a shakedown period until in 1987 their leader became a man called Preston Manning. And only a couple of years after that there was a by-election in British Columbia and Western Canada, and the Reform Party of Canada elected their first member of the parliament. And they had one member in the federal Canadian parliament. But all this time, the grassroots work was going on, not only in the western provinces, but more and more of the provinces further east. And then only 3 years ago, in 1993, they held a general election, which really changed the whole face of Canadian politics. By 1993, Brian Mulroney was gone. He was gone because his own colleagues could not see any chance of winning another election with Brian Mulroney. So basically they stabbed him in the back and moved him out, and they looked for somebody else. And they found a woman called Kim Campbell, who was formerly the Minister for Defence and had the distinction of being photographed, very photogenic person, in all sorts of risque poses, and was a very high profile and rather air-headed minister. But she was photogenic and she did get attention, and maybe under Prime Minister Campbell, there was some chance that they could hold government in Canada. So she became the leader of the party. But in the 1993 election, the Progressive Conservatives were absolutely wiped out. They went from a government to two seats, and the Prime Minister herself lost her seat. Now, the election was won by the Liberals, which are the Canadian Socialists, with 172 seats. The Reform Party of Canada won 52 seats. They went from one member of the parliament in 1989 to 52 seats in 1993. The other factor in this whole Canadian situation was the Parti Québécois, or the Quebec separatists, who won 53 seats, one more than the Reform Party, and became the official opposition because the government itself was practically wiped out and couldn't even field an opposition. Now, the most significant and impressive thing about that election was when they looked at the statistics that the Reform Party came second in an additional 57 seats. An additional 57 seats. So what I'm saying is that they found themselves in political circumstances where this new group called the Reform Party basically came from nowhere out in Western Canada to sweep into almost opposition in a space of about 3 years. Well, of course, there were many years of preparation that went into that. But the point is that the whole face of Canadian politics changed abruptly and completely almost overnight. And I don't know what's going to happen in the next general election, due fairly soon, but it appears to me that all this holds some sort of a lesson to us. And the first lesson is that if, as Hugh Mackay says, Graham Campbell and his friends can get his act together, then we could find ourselves in a few years in dramatically altered political circumstances here. And I hear people who say, well, Campbell's a good bloke, but, you know, it can never happen in Australia. They've forgotten the lessons of Canada. If all the elements are there, it can happen. In my view, all the elements are here in Australia. There's a political sea change there that nobody that I know has ever seen before. Not in the magnitude that it exists now. And so, to my mind, a great deal depends on what might happen with Graham Campbell and the Reform Party of Australia and the Australia First Party. Whether they're going to unite or whether they're not, with figures like Ted Drain being a factor in it, perhaps under Graham Campbell's leadership. Well, all this at the moment seems to be in a slight state of flux to me. But if we look to another part of the world where some of the circumstances are different, over in New Zealand, there is such a thing as the New Zealand First Party. Under the leadership of a part Maori member of parliament called Winston Peters, who was formerly a National Party minister. A man of some integrity and a basic, simple, honest person with a bit of political cunning and a bit of political courage. He left the National Party, he said, you blokes are a total disaster, went out on his own, said, we've got to do something about the trade situation, we've got to do something about the immigration situation, we've got to do something about the whole concept of multiculturalism and what's happening to our originally British outlook. And you know, his standing in the polls has just gone up and up and up till now. He's polling at about 22% of the vote in New Zealand. They have an election on October the 28th, I think it is. And under their new political system, Winston Peters and his group are expected to be the key coalition or the key coalition partner in the new parliament in New Zealand. Let's not say it can't happen here. Anything can happen here. So, Mr. Chairman, in my view, what we're looking at is a sort of a revolutionary turning point in Australian politics in which the League of Rights has got a part to play. Now, I'm not suggesting we all rush out and join a political party, no matter how good it is. But I do believe that if somebody is prepared to stand firm on half a dozen very basic policies, the kind we've been talking about tonight, then on the basis of that policy position, that person is worth supporting. But we've got to keep our eye on the ball, politically, on what happens to those basic policies. Let's not permit them to get lost in the pursuit of political power for the sake of having political power. Let's keep them right at the forefront of our thinking in whatever decision we make about supporting or not supporting a thing called Australia First. I have a lot of confidence in Graham Campbell. Not so much because of his ability or his charisma, but simply because he's a genuine person. He has absolute courage. And anyone who's spent half an hour with him comes away saying, well, you know, you wouldn't believe he's a politician, really. I'm not saying he won't make mistakes. I'm sure he will. But I'm saying he's a big enough bloke to say, well, we shouldn't have done that. Let's not do it again. And in my view, if we want to take some part in the political process, it's our responsibility to try and find out what this person proposes and how this group might somehow be assisted to make those political changes in policy terms that are required to get the country back onto a more even keel. Because the only alternative, my friends, in my view, is what our politicians now fear, and that is going down the American road, or even the British road, or even the Canadian road. We need to do what's best for Australia. So we need to look to ordinary Australians to set an example and make a start. And that's you just as much as it is me. Thank you.